Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, your letters and five for five with Steph Curtis. But first, once dismissed, now back in vogue, single-payer health plans are the hot new thing with Democrats. Here's President Obama in 2012 acknowledging that Obamacare could have been different.
It doesn't have a public option. It's not single-payer. If I were designing a system from scratch, I would have designed a more elegant system.
The reason the ACA wasn't single payer? Because it couldn't have passed Congress back then. So has anything changed? Why are Democrats like Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Minnesota gubernatorial candidates Tim Walz and Jeff Johnson talking about single payer?
The Minnesota Care buy-in, or whatever we're going to call it, that is the first step towards single payer, which you have said you would support, which is a terrible bargain for people because we all lose our private insurance and we're all forced onto one government plan. That's what single payer is.
How many of you are on Medicare? How many use the VA?
Many hands go up.
How many want to keep it?
Lots of hands.
Okay. The reason is because you don't mind paying health care dollars to people who actually fix your health. What you don't like doing is paying to people who shuffle papers and then pay CEOs of healthcare companies $80 million a year. That's what you don't like.
Okay, so as you can hear, this is more complicated than it sounds because single payer can encompass a lot of different plans. As our guests join us to explain why, I want to hear from you. Is a national single payer plan worth what comes with it? Likely higher taxes to support it, stricter limits on some kinds of health care, in exchange for possibly lower-priced health care, and more guaranteed coverage for more people. So weigh the differences here as we talk about what this means this morning, and then weigh in on the idea of single-payer. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter, at Carrie NPR. It's K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Our guest today, Sally Pipes, is CEO of the Pacific Research Institute. She's the author of The False Promise of Single-Payer Healthcare, so you know where she stands on this. Sally, welcome. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you, Carrie. Glad to be back.
And Gerald Friedman is with us. He's an executive director of the Hopbrook Institute and professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. And Gerald, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Gerald, let's make sure we explain, as noted in the introduction here, that single-payer can include a Medicare for all kind of plan or a single national insurance program or something in between. Do you think what we assume single payer to be is often misunderstood?
Oh, absolutely. Single payer can encompass various different programs, but the basic idea is that everybody would have one insurance plan paid for through tax dollars. So it would be Medicare extended to everybody regardless of age and disability status. Now, where you could have differences would be you could have co-pays, you could have deductibles, or as in most of the Medicare for all plans that are out there, most of the single-payer plans, there are no deductibles and no co-pays. So there are no barriers to access. But the key thing is, we do away with all the administrative waste involved in the billing and insurance-related activities.
We'll get to that.
Lots of money. Okay.
We're going to get to that. Sally, does single-payer automatically mean comprehensive, or could it be single-payer for catastrophic care, or, you know, single-payer for some element of the healthcare system? Or do you see this as it is comprehensive and that's one of the That's one of the definitions of it.
Well, thanks, Carrie. Yes, single payer to me means single payer. There is one single payer, and that is the government. And that is what Bernie Sanders has been pushing since 2016 in his plan when he was running against Hillary Clinton for the nomination for the Democratic candidate for presidency, and then his 2017 plan, which has 16 Senate co-sponsors from people like you mentioned, Elizabeth Warren, Kristen Gillibrand, Cory Booker, and Kamala Harris from California. What Keith Ellison and his group under the Medicare for All caucus, these are all plans that are out there that are single payer, meaning there would be no private insurance, no deductibles, and that is single payer. As you know, Carrie, I'm Canadian. Bernie Sanders' plan is even more comprehensive than Canada's. And Canada is the only developed country in the world that has a true single-payer system, i.e. a ban on any payment for things that are considered medically necessary.
Okay, since we've mentioned Bernie Sanders, we have an excerpt from some of the speeches that Senator Sanders has been giving about Medicare for All. So let's listen to how he talks about it.
The strengths of a Medicare for All program are not only its universality and its cost effectiveness. It also ends the complexity of a system which adds enormous stress at a time when people need it the least.
Okay, so there he is, Gerald, talking about what you just mentioned, which is it, I think you said, eliminates a lot of the administrative complexity. Why?
Well, because much of what goes on in doctors' offices is involved in billing multiple companies with different codes, different rules, and this enormous complexity eats up about 15% of our medical dollar. You have more people employed at Massachusetts General Hospital in doing billing than they have beds. And all that would go away because you would just... Everybody would be on one plan, one set of codes, one set of rules. Much, much simpler. You could actually do it by swiping a card and typing in a diagnostic code and a treatment code. Plus, there's all the marketing activities that go on in insurance companies. Mm-hmm. There's the advertising. There's the utilization review conducted where they try to figure out how they can avoid paying. There's all the back and forth that goes on between insurance companies and providers. And all that eats up about 20% of your premium dollar. You take it all together, we would be saving as much as 30% of what we currently spend by doing away with unnecessary administrative waste.
Sally, Gerald, if I might, Sally, how can we argue with less money on administration, more money for the health care we want to need?
Well, you know, I mean, I agree. We should be spending less. America has the highest percentage of their GDP spent on health care. I believe that we need to open up the health care system to more competition, not less. But, you know, if you look at what the Urban Institute costed Bernie's original plan out, it was $32 trillion over 10 years. Currently, we spend $3.2 trillion on healthcare every year. So that would be, you know, the exact same amount for single payer. And then when you look at the Charles Blayhouse from the Mercatus Institute, he said $32.6 trillion over 10 years. And that was after some savings for administrative costs and for lower prescription drug prices. So we are looking at, if you're looking at $3.2 trillion a year adding to the healthcare cost, we're going to have, as Blayhouse said, doubling payroll taxes and income taxes and corporate taxes would not be enough to cover such a program. So it would be, and if you look at Medicare system for our seniors, when that came in under President Johnson, it cost $3 billion in the first year, and they had predicted $12 billion by 1990. In fact, it cost $110 billion. So I'm not even convinced that if the government took over the healthcare system completely, that administrative costs would be less, because I don't see the government as that efficient. When you look at the DMV, you look at the post office, you look at monopoly programs run by government.
Gerald, I have to say that even Senator Sanders recently conceded that his Medicare for All plan would require increased taxes. I mean, in Vermont, I think the governor estimated that it would require a payroll tax hike of possibly 11.5%. Are the estimates of increased costs correct? And how would you, are there ways to get around that?
Well, first of all, you have to distinguish. Let me correct one thing, Dr. Pipes. We spent $3.7 billion this year, not $3.2 billion.
Okay.
But more important, yes, we would have more taxes. But you've got to think, we pay for health care now out of two pockets. The premium dollars that go to insurance company comes from one pocket. That's basically a private tax that we pay to Aetna or whatever company you have.
Uh-huh.
Mine is Aetna. And then we have the public pocket. About 60% of our current spending comes out of the public pocket, which is taxes. The private pocket is the pocket that would go away. When we do away with the private pocket, we're saving 40%, and a lot of that would lead to decreased spending overall. The key thing is not how much we pay in taxes, but how much we public taxes, but how much we pay overall. And even in the Blahaus study at Mercatus, he found we would save $200 billion a year for 10 years, $2 trillion in less spending overall. And that's the bottom line that matters, even though it's interesting in his study they didn't include the 10-year sum.
But this is an important point that I don't want to miss, and then I'm going to go to some calls on this, but that when we hear an increase in out-of-pocket taxes, right, for individual Americans, you're saying it gets made up in other costs that are not going to be incurred through premiums, through out-of-pocket spending on health care.
Government, if you want to compare administrative costs, don't do it with the post office. I don't know anything about the post office. I use email. But do it with Medicare. Medicare, traditional Medicare, has an administrative burden of 1.7%. 98.3 cents out of every dollar goes to care. If you buy an insurance policy, the average is about 80 cents out of every dollar goes to care, with an administrative waste of 20 cents out of the dollar. That's the relevant comparison. Government is much more efficient at cutting checks.
Sally,
which is why Canada is cheaper than the U.S. for health care.
I'm coming back to you, Sally, in just a minute here, but I want to grab a couple calls about this to Jody in St. Louis Park. Hi, Jody. What's your experience with this?
Very much so. I grew up part of my life in Canada. I was born in the States, but moved to Canada when I was younger. And my father and I actually sat down and figured out that what he lives in Montreal now, but what he pays in taxes is still less than what our out-of-pocket expenses are. Because if you look at the average person pays for health care through an employee around an average of $200 to $300 a month. This is through an employee. My sister, who's not through an employee, pays $1,800 a month.
Okay.
Plus, you have $3,000 deductible. If it's in your service, $7,000.
Okay. Hey, Jody, your phone line is cutting in and out. I think I've caught most of what you had to say there. I'm going to grab another call here from Catherine in Minneapolis. Hi, Catherine. You worked in healthcare, is that right?
Yeah, I worked in healthcare here in Minnesota, so I've kind of seen how the back end works and how many hands one single claim passes through, how many different companies, and, you know, I would call that rent seeking myself, and
okay.
It was, you know, a little scary. And then on the flip side, I also lived in England for a time, and so I've experienced the NHS firsthand, and, you know, just the freedom of being able to just walk in and get care. And one thing that I don't understand about the national conversation here in America and in Minnesota and amongst your callers is why it's always spoken of like an ultimatum, as if there's only government health care and everything else goes away, because that's not the case in England. You know, people still have private insurance and
which they purchase, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they know they have that baseline guarantee of being able to access care through the NHS, especially if it's emergency care, that's always there. And if they want, you know, more options,
you can buy into it.
Insurance.
Got it. Sally, why does the conversation often get phrased as it's single payer and nothing else? And, you know, and that worries people because many of us do end up liking the healthcare systems that we're using.
Right. So we have, Carrie, about 160 million Americans who have employer-based coverage. And the polling shows they rate it either as good or as excellent. Your caller that just called in talked about the National Health Service and private coverage. Yes, when the NHS was designed, they allowed private coverage, and about 10% of Brits have private coverage. 90% are covered under the National Health Service. If you've seen the latest numbers, 4.3 million Brits are on waiting lists. People are, you know, dying in hospitals. Ambulances can't meet the quota time that they have been set. And in the recent release that came out from the National Health Service, they are saying that general practitioners, because there's a shortage of 11,000 GPs in England and 42,000 nurses, that they're going to have group appointments of 15 people
Sally,
at one
time. That sounds like America right now. Can't get in to see my GP, not enough family physicians, ambulances don't get there in time. I don't think you're talking about anything that Americans aren't familiar with.
Well, and then then let's go to Canada, which has a true single-payer system. When the Canadians designed their system, they went to the Brits and said, what was the big mistake you made? And they said, allowing private care so that people could compare. So today in Canada, the average wait from seeing a primary care doctor to treatment by a specialist last year, 21.2 weeks, over 5 months. 63,000 Canadians cross the border, carry every year to get treatment in the U.S. because the waiting time is too long. Even Michael Bublé, the crooner, brought his son from Vancouver, where he lives, to UCLA for his liver cancer treatment at age 3. So I think people have to really understand that in Canada, there's also a doctor shortage. My cousin's an ophthalmologist. But the thing is that, yeah, there's a payer, the B.C. government. But the B.C. government does not pay quickly, and they never get increases. And under Bernie's plan, they're talking about paying docs Medicare rates 30 to 40%
right
below what they get. And the new head of the AMA just said that single payer is not going to work because, as the American Association of Medical Colleges has just come out, a shortage of 121,000 docs by 2030.
Gerald, let me take some of that bit by bit. Why does the conversation always sound like, as our caller asked, either or, you can't have both?
Well, that's because I guess people don't talk to me. If you talk to me, I definitely...
Okay.
Wow. I mean, it doesn't have to be. Single payer is not the National Health Service. The National Health Service, the government in Britain, the government employs doctors. That's not what we're talking about with single payer. Single payer doesn't have to involve a government monopoly of insurance. You could still have private coverage. You could still have... the great majority of people wouldn't bother because... the plans, at least the ones that I've worked on, all involve very extensive benefits. But if you want something else, go get something else. This is America. It's a free country. I would like to point something out about Canada, though.
Uh-huh.
Back in 1971, when the Canadians established Medicare, that's what they call it because they like to make fun of us, they established Medicare, the single-payer system. We in Canada were spending about the same amount on health care as a share of GDP, and Canadians lived about a year longer than us. Now, we spend 60% more than Canada, 18% of GDP compared to 11%, and they now live 2.5 years longer than us. And it's not because they're coming across the border to get health care. The numbers that Dr. Pipes talked about are tiny, and they're balanced, more than balanced, by Americans who go across the border to Canada to buy drugs and receive other medical treatment, not to mention the number of doctors who leave the United States to go to Canada. I've spoken to several of them myself because they're so sick and tired of dealing with the insurance industry.
Okay.
One reason we have problems with doctors in this country, the number, is because so many are leaving the profession because of the humiliation and the expense of dealing with insurance.
This is a conversation about single payer. You're hearing a lot of good talk about detail here and policy and the political debate. And you're hearing a lot about it on the campaign trail. So we were hoping this show would inform you about what it's really about, what to be listening for as you hear the discussion during the midterms and beyond. This conversation goes on, especially because there are some high-profile Democrats talking about Medicare for All. Gerald Friedman with us, executive director of the Hopbrook Institute and professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts, and Sally Pipes with us, CEO of the Pacific Research Institute in L.A. She is the author of The False Promise of Single-Payer Healthcare. I'm asking you, as you hear our conversation develop, what this sounds like to you. Is a national single-payer plan worth what comes with it? You hear opinion on this. And is it? Do you feel like it guarantees more coverage for more people, and that's worth what it costs? How does that sound to you? 651 227-6000, 800-242-2828. On Twitter here, Mel says, never mind the obvious benefit that every American would be covered. It would be a huge social and economic equalizer. Sally, very quick question. Would every American be covered under a single-payer plan?
Well, technically, yes, and that's what in Canada, everybody has a Medicare card. But as Madam Chief Justice Beverly McLaughlin, who just retired from the Canadian Supreme, as head of the Canadian Supreme Court, said, access to a care card does not mean access to health care.
Understood.
That is the key.
Noted what you said about Canadians buy private insurance to enhance their health care coverage. To John in Minneapolis. Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm concerned about getting the business, private enterprise, out of the healthcare business. I'm a small business owner, and I can't afford to hire anybody because I'm all of a sudden saddled with having to pay their healthcare.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's a tax, and it increases the cost of products.
So, John, you think a single-payer plan would be advantageous to a small business owner like yourself?
Well, I do, because then I wouldn't have to pay health care for employees.
Gerald, is that how it would work?
Oh, absolutely. We are hurting our businesses. We're hurting our economy by putting the burden of health care on business, where it should be spread among the entire population. And, you know, as far as getting to see a doctor, Canadians go to the doctor almost six times a year. Americans go four times a year. Canadians, by and large, have no problem getting in to see doctors. There are wait times for some elective surgeries. But I have a friend who's been waiting 2 years to have a knee replacement because she's waiting until she can get onto Medicare. And we see that in the United States. A lot of people in the 60s, even in their late 50s, wait until they can get onto Medicare because their private insurance is inadequate.
Sally, I read the opinion piece on the California debate and model, and in which that you wrote that predicted that businesses would move out of California and doctors would retire or move away. And I remember hearing projections that when the ACA was being debated, American businesses were never going to tolerate this. They were going to close their doors, move somewhere else where they didn't have to, you know, businesses over 50 that were required to participate in the ACA. Some did that, but by and large, many companies accepted it. So what makes you think the projections that you're making are any more accurate than some of those projections during the ACA?
Well, because I think that, you know, a lot of employers, you know, under Obamacare, you know, had to accept it. I mean, if you have a ski resort, you can't pick it up and move it to Mexico. But we've certainly seen under Obamacare, the premiums have gone up. Only 11 million Americans signed up on the exchanges, which is a very small part when you think we have 330 million people in this country.
But,
in California,
but many of whom have insurance through their employers. I just want to make sure we're not distorting the numbers here.
No. But I mean, 160 million people have employer-based coverage. And in fact, I actually don't like the fact that we have employer-based coverage. This was a gift to companies during World War II. When wage and price controls were in, it was a way for employers to be able to hire people because they were paying for their health care, and companies got the ability to write it off. We don't get our car insurance, our house insurance, our long-term care insurance through our employer, and we shouldn't be getting our health care through our employer.
I'm more taking issue with what you said about in your op-ed about, well, if California does this, businesses are going to close their doors and move somewhere else. And I remember the same kind of predictions.
We're certainly seeing that. Toyota moved out of the state. A number of doctors have already retired. And the number that came out of the American Association of Medical Colleges is showing that, as I mentioned, 131,000 would retire by 2030, a 16% increase from what they predicted a year ago. And so doctors, I mean, I know many doctors. My husband's own doctor sent him a letter 3 months ago saying, because of the ACA and all the paperwork involved with this, I'm quitting medicine. I mean,
that sounds like an argument for single payer that you've just made there.
No. It's an argument for the fact that a doctor wants to be able to practice the kind of medicine that he's trained to do and not be subject to restrictions of what comes out under a government program.
All right. Let me grab a call here from Greg in St. Paul. Hi, Greg. You say you're a little concerned about the idea of single payer. Tell me why.
Oh, I'm not unalterably opposed to it, but I am a little bit concerned because, well, just from the common sense perspective that, like, well, with every other vendor I've got or any other store, if I'm unhappy with the service, I can just pick up the phone and choose another vendor. And the thing that scares me about single payer or even more government in healthcare is that essentially it reduces my choices and it makes things less flexible. And if I'm unhappy, I just can't go elsewhere.
Gerald, is that a fair complaint about it? Less choice.
There's some legitimacy to it, which is why I, for one, believe we need to keep a private option. But if I'm unhappy with my insurance right now, all I can do is change jobs, which is not realistic. I have tenure.
Mm-hmm.
So, most Americans cannot pick up and change their insurance, which means they're increasingly restricted in which doctors they can see because of the rise of networks and restricted access. You know, a couple things. I feel like I keep chasing after some of what Dr. Pipe says. The share of Americans with insurance went up with the Affordable Care Act, and
yes,
she knows that. And if you talk about costs, for reasons that are not entirely clear, you know, there's an active debate that I'm sure she's aware of, but the rate of increase in costs and in premiums slowed dramatically.
Yeah, Gerald, we just did a show on that yesterday. Yes.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry I didn't get it.
That's all right. I didn't expect you to, but thank you for reinforcing that. Gerald, did you want to add anything?
Yeah. Okay. And as for access and ability to see a doctor soon, in the United States, 57% report that they were not able to see a doctor within the same day when they were sick. In Canada, only 45%. Now, you can't always just walk in and see a doctor, but Canada, with its single-payer system, actually has the best rate of same-day access to doctors of any country in the OECD.
Okay. We'll get a look at the latest news when we come back, continuing our conversation on single payer with Sally Pipes from the Pacific Research Institute and Gerald Freeman from the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, a listener on Twitter saying, like many other folks replying here, I am a health care voter. Both my husband and I are self-employed. Health insurance is our single biggest expense. It's bigger than our mortgage and our food costs combined. That's why a number of candidates, members of Congress, candidates for governor are talking about health care this season and why we're talking about it as well. And we'll continue this discussion about single payer in just a minute. Back to the conversation now with Sally Pipes from the Pacific Research Institute, Gerald Freeman from the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, and to the phones here to Kim in Minneapolis. Kim, thanks so much for waiting.
Yeah. So I'm a Canadian living in Minneapolis, and I lived in Montreal, which is a very large city.
Uh-huh.
Never, ever waited for healthcare ever. Also lived in a very small town in Saskatchewan. Never waited for healthcare. People do wait for knee replacements and surgeries like that. But I just think it's really, I get very frustrated with people holding up millionaire celebrity Canadians who choose to come to the United States for healthcare.
Like Michael Bublé,
Michael Bublé. He can go wherever he wants. The other thing is that part of the reason we're experiencing kind of a drain of physicians out of Canada is because of the commodification of healthcare here in the U.S. I mean, they're encouraged by drug companies, by, you know, institutions of, you know, colleges to come here. And that's part of the reason they're leaving.
Good to hear the experience from Canada, Kim. Thank you. I'm going to take a call here from Doug in River Falls. And Doug, you've got the experience from Korea with this. How does it work there?
Okay, so I lived there for 9 years. And while I was there, it's a kind of combined national plan that has levels of, so a basic level of service that everybody gets. And if you want to pay a little extra, you can go to special clinics or get additional services or faster or different kinds of service. And while I was there, I had to get a back surgery at one time. Something cut out of my back. Uh-huh. And I had to go in for pre-care, the surgery itself, and post-care. And the whole price of that was $70 for all that service. I've been here in the States where I've had to wait a long time to get any kind of service, even though I have a health care plan.
Okay.
With my employer,
so,
and the cost has just been exorbitant.
Doug, I think I hear you saying, and Gerald and Sally, we've had an example from Canada. Sally, I know what you think about the Canadian system, but also this example from Korea. Sally, may I ask you if there are any countries doing this that might be, in your view, a legitimate model for moving towards a single payer?
Well, of course, I mean, 50% of healthcare in the U.S. is in the hands of government today. Carrie, we have Medicare, we have for our seniors, we have Medicaid now to cover for the low-income people. We have the CHIP program for children and the VA,
yep.
which is a single-payer system, which
right.
we've seen a lot of discontent among the VA, among waiting times, lack of access to doctors and things. So I, as a model, I like the American model. We need to make some changes. We need to, you know, get rid of mandates. If I want to buy a plan that has, you know, in vitro fertilization, I should be able to buy it. But you shouldn't have to buy a plan if you don't want that and subsidize what I want, because the mandates add 20% to 50% to the cost of a premium.
Sally,
so we need
Sally,
to open
do I wait a minute? I want to be clear about something. Are you saying that if we were to, you know, repeal the ACA, let's go back to the way it was before because that worked? Is that your argument?
I'm saying we should repeal and replace the ACA with a plan that offers all kinds of different plans for people, so that some people who are low income, they would be on Medicaid. Our seniors can continue on Medicare. And by the way, about 20% of the 60 million people on Medicare have to buy Medigap or Medicare Advantage plans because their doctors won't take them because the Medicare reimbursement rates are too low. So we need PPOs, we need HMOs, we need all kinds.
Well, but we had all that, and there were still millions of uninsured Americans. Gerald, please feel free to jump in.
People have Medigap policies because Medicare is very limited in what it covers. You know that. The pipes. I mean, they're 20% cost sharing beyond a certain number of hospital days, limits on the number of free hospital days, and very high copays associated with Medicare. That's why you have Medicare. You don't have Medicare
policies. The issue is that what Bernie Sanders, Alexander,
I think only one of you are going to have to talk at a time because Gerald's phone cuts out when anybody else speaks. Gerald, finish what you were going to say, and then I'll have Sally come in.
Oh, okay. Okay. Their surveys find very few doctors, maybe 1-2% in most areas, refuse to take Medicare. And those that do are at the high end. And I'm fine. If you want to be a rich Canadian or a rich American and go to some private clinic, fine. That's not a problem. I'm mostly concerned with what the economic consequences of the waste in the system and covering everybody. And nothing Dr. Pipes saying is going to give us universal coverage.
Sally, go ahead.
Well, I believe that we will get to universal. First of all, President Obama had two main points on Obamacare. One was to lower the cost curve. That has not happened. And the second was to achieve universal coverage. And it didn't happen. And of course, the young people did not buy into the exchange plans because the premiums were so expensive. Therefore, you know, they would pay the individual mandate because it was cheaper than buying coverage. And so other people had to pay higher premiums in order to cover those people who were sicker and had chronic conditions.
You're saying that the risk pool didn't work as it was originally planned, although it has improved. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm saying that actually what should happen is that if the federal government wants to be more involved in healthcare, they should put at least $2 billion a year into the states so that states can set up high-risk pools so that those people who are in the individual market who have chronic conditions would be able to get good coverage, and younger and healthier people wouldn't have to subsidize to such an extent those people.
Okay, so if I heard you right, let's have the federal government spend more money on health care in the states because that way we would cover more people in the states. That sounds to me like you're saying the federal government ought to get...
I mean, that is one aspect of the after repeal and replacement of Obamacare that I think the federal government has a role. And we're just seeing right now with the 1332 waivers giving the states more opportunities to run their own healthcare systems in the way that they would like to run them, rather than having the feds dictate from Washington.
Okay. Let me take some more calls here to Jack in St. Paul. Hey, Jack. Hi. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. How are you? So I'm a semi-retired practicing orthopedic surgeon who was in practice for 40 years. I just want to correct a couple things. Number one, I lecture nationally and internationally on total joint stem cell injections. And the wait times in Canada, I can tell you, I just got back from a lecture forum up there, are about 3 years for a total joint. If you strain your knee and you need an MRI, it's 6 months, and you'll be very lucky to get that operated on the first year. And I can tell you that's a real problem if you don't want to develop arthritis of your knee. And the second comment I wanted to make is the gentleman who said you have trouble getting in to see a physician the same day. We have urgent cares all over the Twin Cities. You can see a physician within 2 hours if you have a problem. Mm-hmm. And then the third point I wanted to make is that when we were processing claims for Medicare, it was about 9% of our expense. When we started processing United Healthcare claims or other claims from private insurers, it's literally tripled that amount, which I think is one of his points he was implying. And then the final comment is, why do we have health insurers in this country posting profits of $92 billion a quarter? You guys know who I'm talking about. Why shouldn't that go to patient care? I find it ludicrous that insurers are able to get away with that kind of profitability and then argue that they only have a 10 to 15% overhead, which we know from an audit on one of our big insurance companies was absolutely false several years ago.
Jack, thanks for that. Lots to talk about. But Gerald, we have not discussed what this would mean for health care providers. And that presumably is why many of them oppose it. I mean, the large insurance companies.
The insurance companies would be put out of business. The health insurance companies, there's no question that they have good reason to oppose it. They're very profitable right now, by and large. The average CEO for the 10 largest health insurance companies earned almost $20 million last year. Those people have a very strong vested interest in fighting single payer. As for providers, they would largely be held harmless. If you lowered rates to the Medicare level and took away billing and insurance-related excessive billing and insurance-related expenses, basically lowered those to the Canadian level, then basically it's the same. You know, most of the excess cost comes from the cost of billing and billing insurance companies.
Okay.
Now, as for the coverage, you know, we tried state risk pools in many states, probably in Minnesota. I know we had it in Massachusetts. It doesn't work. The whole problem with healthcare is that there's a very concentrated cost among a very few people. That's why people want insurance for healthcare. And if you just leave, you know, insurance companies to skim off the healthiest people, then, yeah, they'll have low rates, but people likely to become sick will be paying exorbitant rates that they can't afford. That's why we have insurance. We spread the risk around to everybody. That's what it's all about. And everything Dr. Pipes and the Trump administration are talking about is designed to concentrate risk and concentrate costs among people who are likely to get sick. Those with pre-existing conditions and the like.
So as I mentioned yesterday, we talked about what was happening with premiums. And one of our guests was Dr. Renee Critchlow. And I asked her towards the end of the show why she was such a strong advocate for single payer. Here's what she said.
And the idea that a physician would be able to not have to worry about filling out 50,000 different forms for credentialing, 50,000 different forms for getting paid, the reduced administrative level of that is very enticing. The fact that every one of your patients would be covered is also very mm-hmm. enticing. The challenge is going to come in to how does that actually, what does the structure actually look like? But honestly, if you look at the rest of the world, the high-achieving countries have a more, less fragmented insurance payment plan.
Okay. We were also talking with Catherine Hempstead yesterday from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, where she administers their health policy work. Here's what she said when I asked about single payer.
I mean, I think the ACA has made a lot of people feel committed to the idea of coverage for all. But then I think the next step is, what is the best and most feasible way to really get to that place? And do you get to that place by actually having a system where you have, you know, a single payer? One interpretation of that is sort of that, you know, everybody pays into, let's say, the federal government, and then the federal government sort of leverages its purchasing power and, you know, becomes the buyer of healthcare.
Sally, Gerald, I just want to ask you as we end the discussion here, politically, which we haven't talked about, but politically, does it seem likely that the United States is going to move to some kind of single payer, even though a lot of Democrats are talking about it? Sally, you first on that.
Right. So as you mentioned at the very start, Carrie, you know, this 5 years ago, there was very little discussion about single payer, but it certainly is in the works now. And you've got Bernie Sanders, who's really raised the issue to a national issue. And healthcare is the number one policy issue in this upcoming election. You've got people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. You've got Andrew Gillum running for the governorship in Florida, who is very much single payer. I don't think the election, of course, is coming up on November 6th. I think that the American people really need to understand what single payer means, single payer being one payer, the government, and what it will mean for their health care.
So I think Sally, you think it would be a heavy lift politically?
A very heavy lift, but it's going to be a big issue, I think, in the 2020 presidential election.
All right,
for
Sally,
sure.
I have to close it there. Thank you very much, as always. Gerald, what's your take on the politics of this?
Oh, God, I'm an economist, not a politician. I think it's a huge lift, probably even a heavier lift than Dr. Pipes is suggesting, because there's so many vested interests. You know, somebody like me, I come along, I say, well, we could save $800 billion, $600 billion, whatever. Every dollar of savings comes out of somebody's income.
Nah.
And, well, a lot of these people, you know, they'll just get another job or something, whatever. But there are a lot of people making a lot of money on the healthcare system, a lot of profits, the drug companies, the big hospitals, the insurance companies, and all these companies are going to fight us like hell. So I think it's going to be very difficult. I think the Democrats will push to do something when they come back to power.
All right. Gerald, I'm going to end it there and really thank you for your participation in the conversation. Thank you much.
Thank you very much for having me.
And listeners, as you hear the discussion develop in the midterms and beyond on single payer, I hope we've helped inform you a bit when you're listening to the campaign rhetoric.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.